This is day five of the 2012 Rogue River Bible School. The speaker is Brother Jim Cowie. His subject is The Prophecy of Zephaniah. The title for today's class is I Will Save Her That Halteth. Brother Jim.
Well, thank you, Brother David. Brothers and sisters, can we start today in two places in our Bible? Can we start in Genesis 12 and in Zephaniah chapter 3, please? I want to confirm in your minds what we established, at least in part yesterday, that the content of Zephaniah 3 is based upon the life of Abraham, and we're going to see this morning that it culminates in the life of Jacob. And you may recall when we first began our series of studies that we pointed out that the roots of Zephaniah were from Genesis 1 to 35. Now, Genesis 35 is really, in many ways, the culmination of the life of Jacob. Hosea tells us that that was the time that he came to Bethel for the second time. And there he found his God. What that means, of course, is that Jacob had finally learnt the lesson that Yahweh had been trying to teach him all of his life. And he only learnt that lesson, brothers and sisters, when he halted upon his thigh. Zephaniah chapter 3 is going to conclude with a people who will be halting upon their thigh, so to speak. And that will be our subject here this morning. It's a wonderful finale of this wonderful little prophecy known by the name Zephaniah. And you and I, I think, have already seen how this applies to ourselves. We're going to see that even more today. And we will go away with the lesson of the life of Jacob ringing in our ears and spiritually continuing to halt upon our thigh, putting absolutely no confidence in the flesh, not glorying in the achievements of men, not thinking that we can make it in our own strength or wisdom, but leaning upon our God. That is the spirit that he's going to restore in his people. He's going to restore the spirit of Jacob, the true Jacob who became Israel, an Israelite indeed, which is why, brothers and sisters, we have been called to become Israelites indeed. That's the core of our study here this morning. So if you've got Genesis 12 open, I want you to have a look again with me at verses 6 to 8. Because Zephaniah 3 verses 8 onwards begins with its roots in the life of Abraham, as we saw yesterday. Verse 6 tells us that having crossed the Euphrates, having become a Hebrew, Abram passed through the land. Just so happens that the word pass through is the Hebrew Abar, the very basic root of the name Hebrew. It comes from Eber. And so here we have this man who's crossed over, and he passes through the land under the place of Shechem. Shechem means, as we said yesterday, the shoulder, the acceptance of responsibility. And we know in the scripture that Shechem is the place of decision making. Here is the place where people decide whether or not they're going to commit themselves and put their shoulder beneath the burden of carrying that which Yahweh has deposited upon them to the kingdom. This is where they do it, brothers and sisters. This is why the woman of Samaria was converted at Shechem. So we know that this is a very important place in the scheme of things. And it says this, that he came unto the plain, it means the oak of Moreh, Moreh meaning the teacher. So he came here to accept responsibility upon the basis of what Yahweh had taught him. And the Canaanite was then in the land. The Canaanite will never disappear, brothers and sisters, until we lose the nature that we bear. We struggle every day with the Canaanite, and so did Abram. In verse 7, we have the promise made to Abram's seed, to Christ. And then we read this, that having built an altar at the end of verse 7, we read in verse 8, and he removed from thence unto a mountain on the east of Bethel, the house of God, pitched his tent, having Bethel on the west and Hai, which means ruin. That's the direction back towards Ur of the Chaldees, back to Babylon. Hai is on the east. And there he built an altar unto Yahweh, and he called upon the name, the Shem of Yahweh. Now, if you've got Zephaniah 3, chapter 3, verses 9 and 10 open, I wanted to just demonstrate again that this is the basis. Genesis 12 is the basis of what we've just read out of Genesis. So here we have Verse 9 of Zephaniah 3. For then I will turn to the people's pure lip, that they may all call upon the name of Yahweh. That comes from Genesis 12, verse 8. Clearly based upon the life of Abraham. To serve him with one consent. Now the margin of my Bible says shoulder. The Hebrew word is Shechem. To serve him with one Shechem, one shoulder. So you see it, this is in reverse to Abraham. This is the process, brothers and sisters. Yahweh's reversing the work of Nimrod. He's going to reverse the character of his people. He's going to take them through the process he took Abraham. He's taking us through that process right now, is he not? And what will that culminate in? Verse 10, well, for Abram, it meant that he had come from beyond the rivers of Cush. And he says here that that's exactly what's going to happen to Israel, his people, when they're recovered by the work of Elijah. They will come from beyond the rivers of Cush, Babylon. And they will be his suppliants, it says in the AV. The word means worshippers. They're going to be committed to him, as Abraham was committed to him. They're going to accept the responsibilities, the Shechem of the truth. They're going to make the choice that Abram made. And so, brothers and sisters, that's how this last section of Zephaniah begins, all based upon the experience of Abraham. And it says at the end of verse 10 that they shall bring mine offering. And Abram set up two altars, one at Shechem and one at Bethel, in the house of God. And there he called upon the name of Yahweh. So we're going to be focusing now on this section from verse 11 to 20, where the remnant is restored and redeemed. And in this section of Scripture, brothers and sisters, we have this content. In verse 8, we've considered that. The nations were assembled, will be assembled at Armageddon. Verse 9, the nations will be given a pure religion. Verse 10, scattered Israel will be recovered from dispersion after the pattern of Abram's call. And in verses 11 to 13, we're going to find that ungodliness is removed from Jacob and a remnant is redeemed. In verses 14 to 17, Israel is saved by a rejoicing warrior king. And in verses 18 to 20, limping Israel will be redeemed and made the head and the praise of all nations. Now, what a wonderful way to conclude our studies on the destiny of God's people, Israel. And you and I, of course, not only are we intimately connected with this because we believe the promises made to Abraham, but brothers and sisters, think about this. When this is actually brought to pass, many of us in this hall, if we are by the grace of God privileged to be there, are going to be involved in this work of recovering God's people. It's going to be a very important part of his purpose. So you and I may well end up being there with Elijah and many other saints involved personally in this work. The deliverance of Jacob will be in two stages. Christ will save the tents of Judah first, we read in Zechariah 12, verse 7. That's the very first thing he does after Armageddon. He establishes the throne of David, and then the third who survive come into his presence. They are greatly humbled by the events of Armageddon. Two-thirds of their nation will have been killed in those events. Families will be bereaved. But the greater bereavement will be when someone sees this man, this glorified man, with wounds in his hands, and they will say, "What are these wounds in thine hands?" And he will look at them and say, "These are the wounds that I received in the house of my friends." And for months on end, that nation will mourn. And they will go into houses apart and weep their heart out for what their fathers did to their own Messiah. And brothers and sisters, weep their heart out for their foolishness and their stupidity and their arrogance, that they could have imagined themselves as a nation to be the Messiah. We'll come to that in the end of our studies today as well. It's going to be a great mourning, like there was for the mourning of Josiah. Josiah? Yeah. Zephaniah was, he was prophesying in the days of Josiah, their great reformer. There'll be a mourning like there was for Josiah. See the connections with this? This, brothers and sisters, is what awaits us, and we're about to see it. This is the work immediately after Armageddon, the salvation of the remnant in Judah. But Jacob, of course, includes the whole nation, And so before Armageddon, Elijah has begun his work. And that work, of course, is the work of regathering them, bringing them into the heart of Europe, and conducting the second exodus of Israel, which will go on for 40 years. And the purpose of that, brothers and sisters, is that there might be judgments brought upon the house of Esau. So here is the pattern of Roman Catholic resistance to Christ after Armageddon. Armageddon will see, of course, a loss of power and prestige for the papacy. And so they will have, brothers and sisters, much to think about. But they won't think very long about serving Christ. Because we're told that in Psalm 2, the nations assemble together and they decide after 10 years to bitterly oppose this one whom they believe is the Antichrist of their teaching. So Rome will be destroyed 10 years after Armageddon. That will see another loss of power for the papal system. But they will rebuild it in Central Europe. Magog and the beast of the earth will reemerge. But then Elijah will have brought Israel into the wilderness of the peoples. And he will bring judgments upon the house of Esau, as they are described in Obadiah, in Isaiah 34 and 63, and Jeremiah 30 and 31. It's all over the prophetic scriptures, brothers and sisters. The house of Esau is the latter-day Babylon the Great, and that can be proven beyond all dispute. No question at all about that. So that's all I'm going to say about that. Confidently, as you can see, because you can nail it down. And we can give you a series of studies that will do that for you if you wish. So brothers and sisters, this is what's going to happen in that 40-year period of divine judgment. And so the second exodus of Israel will see the return of Elijah with the purified remnant of scattered Jewry. And then finally, at the end of that 40-year period of judgment, all nations will submit to Christ's rule, and he will have dominion from sea to sea and from the river, notice the phrase, Psalm 72 verse 8, to the ends of the earth, of his kingdom, there shall be no end. And God will rule in Jacob unto the ends of the earth. That's going to be a fulfillment of what Gabriel said to the mother of our Lord. Now you'll recall the contrasts that form the framework of Zephaniah 3. We're not going to go through those again. We did that in some detail yesterday. But we are going to pick up a couple of themes that we didn't fully amplify yesterday in our studies. And those themes, brothers and sisters, are the name, although we did go through this, and I'm not going to spend too much time on it, but just to summarise, this word Shem occurs 5 times in the book of Zephaniah. And there you can see the references, 1, 4, 3, 9, 12, 19 and 20. Nimrod's rebellion began with the words, "Let us make us a name, a Shem." While God had in Salem already his Shem, his name-bearer, Melchizedek, priest of the Most High God, who was ensconced there in the place where he would put his name. He already had his Shem, but they're going to build another one. They're going to make for themselves a name of blasphemy. So when God has reversed Nimrod's rebellion, all peoples will call on his name, his Shem. The remnant of Israel will trust in his name, and Israel will be given a name among all nations. And why will that be? Well, because you see, the God who had to withdraw himself and to hide his face, back here in Zephaniah 3 verse 5, that God is going to be in the midst of thee. It's a prominent theme. It's something you can highlight in Zephaniah 3, and it will pop out of the page at you. Look at verse 11, towards the middle of the verse. "I will take out of the midst of thee them that rejoice in thy pride." So this is the work that has to be conducted. Christ first, then Elijah will do this work. That's why it says in verse 11, in that day, it's done over a 40-year day, a period of judgment. That's the phrase, of course, that occurs in Zechariah 12 through 14. Over and over again, you read of in that day. It's not a day of 24 hours, because you read the context, it's an extended day. It's an extended day, brothers and sisters, because it's actually 40 years. And a lot of things have to happen in that day. "Shalt thou not be ashamed for all thy doings," says God, "wherein thou hast transgressed against me? I'm going to take away from the midst of thee them that rejoice in thy pride." The word means arrogance. "In your arrogance. And there shall no more be haughty, not because of my holy mountain," but the word should be "in my holy mountain." So God has to withdraw himself because of their arrogance and their pride in his holy mountain. Now, this is certainly true of the people there today, as we're going to see. Verse 12, I will also leave in the midst of thee an afflicted and poor people, and they shall trust in the name, the Shem of Yahweh. We come down to verse 15, towards the end of the verse. The King of Israel, even Yahweh, is in the midst of thee. Thou shalt not see evil anymore. Verse 17, Yahweh thy God in the midst of thee is mighty. So you get the idea of this, brothers and sisters? There's a theme running through here. Now, why would that be the case? Well, you see, we know from the Emmanuel prophecies why it's the case. Because at the end of the Emmanuel prophecy, Isaiah 12, verses 5 to 6, we read these words. This is the song of Israel's redeemed remnant. This is what they sing. Sing unto Yahweh, for he hath done excellent things. This is known in all the earth. Not today. That's tomorrow. Cry out and shout, thou inhabitant of Zion, for great is the Holy One of Israel. In the midst of thee, he can't walk with corruption. He will not fellowship unholiness. It is not in him, brothers and sisters, to compromise. He can't be there when there's corruption in Zion. He has to hide his face from it. And that's what he's doing right now, hiding his face from it. You'll see that in Ezekiel 39. But when that place becomes the habitation of a holy people, a converted people, who are brought from beyond the rivers of Cush, and like Abram, accept the responsibilities of the truth, and call upon the name of Yahweh on the basis of sacrifice, then he can dwell in the midst of them. That's why that theme is there in Zephaniah 3. And there is a lesson for that for you and me, is there not, brothers and sisters? God cannot dwell with corruption. It has to be holiness. And so that is the theme that dominates this section. And you see, because he will redeem them, we come to verse 17 of Zephaniah 3. And just step back to verse 16, perhaps. In that day it shall be said to Jerusalem, fear thou not, and to Zion, let not thine hands be slack. It's time to work. It's time to labour. Why? Well, because they've been converted. That's what verse 17 is about. Yahweh thy God is in the midst of thee. He's mighty. He's a Gibor. He's a warrior. He will be there in the person of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Gibor of Isaiah 9, verse 6, the mighty warrior. He will save. He will rejoice over thee with joy. You know, when people are redeemed, our brother David is going to conclude his studies this morning. When they are converted, brothers and sisters, and we can see clearly that it's genuine, that they have made their peace with God, we should rejoice over that. And we should do all in our power to extend the arm, the right hand of fellowship, as God will do to his people. And that's why it says, he will rest in his love. Now, Rotherham translates that phrase, rest in his love. He will be silent. That's what the word means. He will be silent in his love. In other words, when those people come to him, he will have no criticisms to make. There will be nothing that comes from the mouth of God. Whereas once he had to hew them by the prophets, now he will be silent because they will be at peace with him. There will be rest between God and his people. And he will joy over thee with singing. There will be great delight when the remnant is brought home. So here, the mighty one, the powerful warrior, will have reversed the work of Nimrod. Nimrod hunted and killed. Israel's God calls and he saves. He rejoices. This is a cheerful, enthusiastic, full joy. He will be silent in his love. So Rotherham translates it beautifully. He says, Yahweh thy God in the midst of thee, as a mighty one, will save, will be glad over thee with rejoicing, will be silent in his love, will exult over thee with shouts of triumph. What a wonderful God we serve, brothers and sisters. Are we not a privileged people to know these things today? Well, because we know them today, we're going to be there tomorrow if we are faithful to see it happen to God's people. To turn ungodliness away from Jacob. You want to be involved in that? I do. I would love to be involved in that work. I'd love to see this fulfilled. Would you not? Would you like to be there? When Christ, like Joseph, weeps on the shoulders of those who come back under Elijah, you imagine that event? I'd love to be there. I know you would too. I want you to come, brothers and sisters, to consider with me now Jeremiah chapter 30 and 31. Because this is a very, very similar message to what we have here in Zephaniah 3. In fact, yesterday in our readings we read Jeremiah 23, and Jeremiah 23 is the basis of what we read here in Jeremiah 30 and 31. It was all about dreamers, was it not, yesterday in the reading? The dreamers who misled God's people. You know what happens here? From verse 4 of Jeremiah 30 to verse 26 of 31, God gives Jeremiah a dream. That dream is based upon the life of Jacob. In fact, it is modelled upon the dream that Jacob saw when he went to Bethel. Leaving Beersheba, he came to Bethel on his way to Haran. It's modelled on Jacob's dream. Now, I haven't got time to go into that now, but have a look at verse 26 of chapter 31. This begins in verse 4 of the previous chapter, but in verse 26 we read this. Upon this I awaked and beheld, and my sleep was sweet unto me. So everything that precedes this, back to verse 4 of chapter 30, is part of Jeremiah's dream. Now, guess where the dreamers of chapter 23 were going to end up? In the same destiny as Esau. And Esau figures prominently in this section of Scripture. You have a look with me at verse 8 of Jeremiah 30. It says this. For it shall come to pass in that day, saith Yahweh of armies, that I will break his yoke. So there's a yoke to be broken from off thy neck, and will burst thy bonds, and strangers shall no more serve themselves of him. So we're talking about Jacob here. That becomes obvious from verse 7. It is the time of Jacob's trouble. Now, if I ask you, what was the time of Jacob's trouble? All of you know. It was the time when he came back from Haran and had to encounter his brother Esau. And Brother Thomas points out in Eureka, volume 5, page 48, he says the yoke here is the yoke of Esau. Is he right? We'll turn the page to Jeremiah chapter 31 and verses 10 and 11. Hear the word of Yahweh, O ye nations. Well, that's interesting. And declare it in the isles afar off. Those are words that come from Genesis 10. And say, he that scattered Israel will gather him. Gather him? And keep him, as a shepherd doth his flock. For Yahweh hath redeemed Jacob and ransomed him from the hand of him that was stronger than he. Who would that be? Well, Esau. Because you see, Esau is the type of latter-day Babylon the Great, the Jew-hater, the anti-Semite, who seeks the destruction of his brother. That, brothers and sisters, is the core theme that runs through Jeremiah 30 and 31, the time of Jacob's trouble. Now, all of this is based upon this wonderful piece of scripture, Genesis 32, 13 to 32, the longest night of Jacob's life, where he makes meticulous preparations to meet Esau. He uses his own scheming brain. He sends out five herds and flocks with five bands of his servants and says, when you come to Esau, say this. He choreographs the whole thing meticulously. He doesn't get a wink of sleep, like some of our teenagers haven't got this week. He doesn't get a wink of sleep during the night. The longest night of his life. And in the end, he can't save himself and he can't save his family. It's Yahweh who delivers him from the hand of Esau, his brother, who seeks, or at least he thought, he seeks to kill him. But of course Esau had changed his mind for the time being. So this is the basis of what we have here in Jeremiah's dream. And the story, of course, is well known to us. He flees from Haran. There's a confrontation with Laban at Gilead. Then he hears the news that Esau comes with 400 men from Edom. And what happens? An angel meets him and wrestles with him at Jabbok. Jabbok means emptying. Jacob's going to be emptied of himself. Jacob's going to be emptied of self-reliance. God is going to teach him the greatest lesson of his life. And having put his family over the Jabbok, he's late. He's late. And he's limping on his thigh. I won't mention someone in this audience who does that. But you got the point of that? He couldn't hurry. He couldn't save himself. It was the angels that were ascending and descending upon him that he'd seen at Mahanaim. In verse 1 of Genesis 32, that we're going to save him. This is the basis of the language that is used in Zephaniah and elsewhere. Micah chapter 4, same language is used. I will save her that halteth. So why does it change from him to her? Why from Jacob to her? Well, you see, Yahweh married Israel at Sinai. And the message that Elijah takes out to his wife, who's been outside of his house for 2,730 years, is this, brothers and sisters. I am married unto you, O Israel. Return, backsliding Israel, unto me, and I will receive you. And they do return, smitten, no longer reliant upon themselves, limping upon their thigh. I will save her that halteth, says Yahweh. Got the picture? Well, that picture's going to become vivid because you and I are involved in it. It's the process that's going on in our lives right now. An angel is wrestling with us, brothers and sisters, in the events of everyday life, that we might truly be Israelites indeed, in whom there is no guile, no sense of self-reliance, no trust in the strength of man. That's the lesson that emerges here from Zephaniah chapter 3. Now you might say to me, you haven't quite proved to me yet that this is all based on the life of Jacob. I'm not going to turn with you to Jeremiah 30. We could do that because it's full of it. Just come to Jeremiah 31. It's going to show you a few, just a few. Verse 8, Jeremiah 31. Behold, I will bring them from the north country. So here's the work of Elijah. I'll bring them from the north country and gather them from the coasts of the earth, and with them the blind and the lame. Starting to see. The woman with child. Yes. Who's this woman with child? Well, just cast your eyes across to verse 15. Thus saith Yahweh, a voice was heard in Ramah, lamentation and bitter weeping. Rachel weeping for her children. Refused to be comforted because they were not. So the woman with child coming back to the land with Jacob is Rachel. No question about that. Come back to verse 8. And her that travaileth with child together, a great company shall return thither. Now just keep your hand there. Go back to the beginning of Jeremiah 30 to verses 5 and 6. For thus saith Yahweh, we have heard a voice of trembling and of fear and not of peace. Why? Because verse 7 tells us, this is the time of Jacob's trouble, but he shall be saved out of it. Look at verse 6. Ask ye now and see whether a man, yes, a male, as the margin has it, doth travail with child. Wherefore do I see every man with his hands on his loins, as the woman in travail, and all faces are turned into paleness. So here's the whole nation. Here's Jacob. Now men don't bear children, do they? But everyone's got to go through this experience. And Jacob is going through it. He's holding upon his thigh. We're going to see the relationship to pregnancy a little later on. And what the prophet sees in this wonderful dream, based upon the life of Jacob, based upon Genesis 28 and the dream at Bethel, is every man with his hands on his thigh. Now, women can relate to this. If you're a mother, you can relate to this. Hand on his thigh, pain, agony, until there's a birth. Until Jacob becomes a prevailer with God, which is what Israel means. That's, brothers and sisters, the process which they have to go through. That's why in Jeremiah 31 and verse 8, you've got a woman travailing with child. Look at verse 9 of Jeremiah 31. They shall come with weeping and with supplications. Will I lead them? I will cause them to walk by the rivers of waters in a straight way. And they will not stumble, though limping upon their thigh. Final proof. So we can multiply these, but final proof is verse 19 of Jeremiah 31. Surely after that I was turned, I repented. And after that I was instructed, I smote upon my thigh. Got it? I smote upon my thigh. That's palpably obvious where that's coming from. So this is all based upon the life of Jacob. So having had that background, and it's a very brief background about Jeremiah's dream, I want to come back now to where that is sourced. It's sourced from Genesis 32. This is where it becomes very personal, brothers and sisters, for you and me. Because we're all going through this process right now. If we're going to be turned from heel catchers with our hand on Esau's heel, then we need to go through this process to release our grip on Esau's heel, so that we might not be any more Jacobs, but Israels, prevailers with God. And that's what happens here in Genesis 32, isn't it? Now look at verse 24. Having spent the night preparing for his encounter with Esau, having used every single machination of his brain to choreograph this event, here he is, left alone. Now think about this, brothers and sisters. What man in his right mind would send over his beloved family across the Jabbok and then would dilly-dally behind north of the stream, knowing that they're going into the teeth of Esau? What man would do that? Well, not a coward, but a man who's desperate. Absolutely desperate to find one of the angels, at least one of the angels that he'd seen in verse 1 when he named the place Mahanaim, incorrectly, by the way. It means two camps. God had told him in Genesis 28, my angels are ascending and descending upon you. All right? There was only one camp. The angels of Yahweh encamp around those who fear him. He only had one camp, but he thought he had two. By the time he's done all this, he's got three, because he divides his own camp into two. We wouldn't be like that, would we? We'd never place any reliance upon our own ability to solve our problems, would we? Well, Jacob did, and we're very much like him. At least I am. I can't speak for you. My name is James, and James is the anglicised form of Jacob. I know a bit about what went through Jacob's mind. Okay? We're all probably much the same. We need to learn this lesson in life. Jacob was left alone. And it's when you're alone, brothers and sisters, that your relationship with your God is most seriously tested, isn't it? That's when you find out how close your relationship is with your God. That's when you find out how powerful the truth is working in your life. True? When you're left alone. And Jacob was here seeking the angels, and there wrestled a man with him. Now, we know that this was an angel. I've heard all sorts of nonsense about this. But Hosea 12, verse 4 is clear. This was an angel. By the way, when was the last time that a human being could touch? And some people think this was Esau. It's ridiculous. When was the last time when a human being could touch your thigh like this, and it goes, boing! It was dislocated. And that wasn't bad for someone with my disease, was it? Shortly I'll be walking like another brother. But when was the last time that happened? Well, it doesn't happen. This is clearly an angel of God. But why does it call him a man? Why a man and not an angel here? Hosea 12:4 says it was an angel. Well, there's a reason. There's two very important things we have to learn about this story, brothers and sisters. It says there wrestled a man or an angel with him. Jacob did not start this wrestling. And nor did you or I start the wrestling that's going on in your life right now. Right? Who started it? God. He initiated the struggle in us. So there wrestled an angel, a man, with him. So why does it call him a man? Well, because you see, God uses the circumstances of everyday life among men. When you go to work, brethren, you're confronted with Esau-like characters, aren't you? You were born with your hand on Esau's heel. Right? So you have to rub shoulders with Esau's every day of your life. Sometimes in the ecclesia, it's not always easy going, is it? Everyday life in the ecclesia is not always smooth sailing. What's that about? God is testing you. He's wrestling with you in the everyday circumstances of your life. That's why he's called a man. See that? It is a wonderful way of bringing us all into this story. And this is what he's going to do with his people. When he sends out Elijah, he's going to bring them into Europe. Why? Well, because they're going to clash with Esau. They're going to have to fight their way through Europe. And in the everyday circumstances of life, like their forefathers in the wilderness under Moses, they're going to learn to trust their God. That's the principle involved here. Not to rely upon their own strength or the machinations of their own brain. Now, God's method is to put the thigh out of joint. See what it says? Let's just read this story, shall we? Verse 24. There wrestled a man with him until the breaking of the day. Now, we're about to see the breaking of the day, are we not? The dawning of a wonderful new era, when everything's going to be different for you and me, brothers and sisters, and we're going to lose our grip upon Esau's heel forever. It's going to be gone. That's what we're waiting for. And what's Jacob doing? Well, he's doing what we do right now. Verse 25. And when he saw that he prevailed not against him, he touched the hollow of his thigh, and the hollow of Jacob's thigh was out of joint. And what that means is dislocated. So his thigh is dislocated. Ever had a dislocated finger? Very painful. I used to play football. Boing, ball. And your finger would be like this. Some chap on the field would come up and grab your finger and go, put it back in. And there, you could hardly use your hand. How about your thigh? Come on. Incredible pain. But what's Jacob doing? Verse 26. The angel says, let me go, for the day breaketh. And he said, I will not let thee go, except thou bless me. That word bless is the word God used for Abraham. You know what we're told in Acts 3, 25, 26, that actually means turning everyone away from their iniquities. It means the process of God redeeming men, of turning them away from iniquity. Acts 3, 25, 26 is the proof of that, because it quotes the promise that God made to Abraham. Okay? I will not let thee go, he says, until you bless me. And brothers and sisters, I know that most of you, if not all of you, have got your arms around the angel of God, so to speak. And though you're in pain, though you have the intense agony of a dislocated thigh, you are not going to let go until he redeems you. And neither am I. I am going to hang on until the breaking of the day, and so will you. That's the lesson that comes out of the life of Jacob here at Jabbok. And we can all relate to that. So what about this thigh? We're going to see in a moment. It's got all to do with self-reliance. And so his name is changed. Verse 27. He said unto him, what is thy name? And he said, Jacob, a hill catcher. I was born with my hand on Esau's heel. He said, thy name shall be called no more Jacob, but Israel. Israel actually means to prevail. Listen to this. Proof is in Hosea 12, 3 to 6. You can look it up yourself. It means to prevail over God. How does a man prevail over God? Hosea 12 tells you. He prevailed over the angel. How? He made supplication. And he wept. And God finds that irresistible in his children, brothers and sisters. Whereas you and I can turn away from that, God cannot. It is impossible for him to turn away from the sincerity of his servants who are hanging on to him, seeking that he will work in their lives to redeem them. When they can't do it themselves, he will not and cannot resist that. And in that sense only, men prevail over God. Weeping and supplication. So your name is no longer Jacob. Your name is Israel. But then see, Jacob does something that you and I probably might have done. Just get the idea. He's got his arms around the angel, which means that their faces are like this. And the angel says, what's your name? He says, Jacob. He says, your name is no longer Jacob, it's Israel. And Jacob says, well, what's your name? He says, mind your own business. Why? Because he's telling them this is not a relationship of equality. Don't get the idea that this is your doing, that there's some kind of equality here. This is my work. You leave it to me. Got it? Very powerful lesson, that, brothers and sisters. So we read at the end of verse 28, "For as a prince hast thou power with God and with men, and hast prevailed." But you know what? He's not called Israel until Genesis 35, 21. Why? He still had the Syrian. And there was a semantic link between the names Syria and Edom. He still had the Syrian in his company. And Deborah, Rebekah's nurse, dies. Genesis 35, verse 8. And Rachel dies just short of Bethlehem, Judah. She represents natural Israel sent to Babylon, Micah 4 tells us. The one who wept when they came back from Babylon for her children, when Herod sent his men to kill all the babies in Bethlehem. Rachel, weeping for her children. Okay? That's the picture we get. And then, when he's just buried Rachel and her body is not even cold, and he searched through her stuff and finds the teraphim of Laban, the record says, "And Israel journeyed beyond the tower of the flocks." The first time that he's called Israel in the record. The Syrian has gone from Jacob's life. But immediately it tells us that Israel had 12 sons. Right? And one of them, his eldest, Reuben, brought the Syrian back into his family and went into his father's concubine. And it says, Jacob had 12 sons. So the Syrian's back. That's exactly what happens in our lives, brothers and sisters. It's a topsy-turvy process, isn't it? It's a wrestling process. So why does he call it Peniel? And then the record calls it Peniel. Look at verse 30. "Jacob called the name of the place Peniel, for I have seen God face to face, and my life is preserved." In the Hebrew, "I have seen God" is in the first person singular. This is Jacob's personal lesson. But then we read this in the record of verse 31. "And as he passed over Peniel," now it's a different spelling. Well, the translators have got this right. Peniel means, because it's in the third person plural, they have seen God. And that's why Hosea chapter 12 says that when he came to Bethel the second time, there he found God, and there he spake with us. Got it? That's why the two names are there. And the end of this chapter says in verse 32, "Therefore the children of Israel eat not of the sinew which shrank, which is upon the thigh." Why don't they eat that? Well, because the thigh is the strongest part of your body. Lift a weight, don't do this. Do this. Use the strongest part of your body, your thigh. That's the part that's touched. That's the part that's dislocated. See? So the children of Israel, the family builders of Israel, who are learning to be Israelites indeed, don't eat of the sinew of the thigh. Now, we're not talking literally here. We're talking spiritually. What does it mean? Don't put any trust in the strength of man. That's the lesson he's taught. And so he held it upon his thigh, the record says. It was out of joint, it was dislocated. And Carter says the sciatic nerve, the longest in the human body, runs from the lower back through the pelvic region and down the back of the leg. To relieve the pain, sufferers often walk by bending the affected knee of the leg at the knee and rotating it outwards. So they walk sort of like this to take the pressure off the sciatic nerve. Sciatica sometimes occurs during pregnancy when the sciatic nerve is pinched between the head of the fetus and the pelvic wall. Sciatic pain is the closest thing a man can experience to the pain of childbirth. So how does Jeremiah's dream begin? "Why do I see every man with his hands on his loins as a woman in travail with child?" Because they've all got to go through that process, brothers and sisters. They've all got to have self-reliance taken out of them. They've all got to have arrogance removed. That's the lesson. So Ezekiel 39 says this. Now consider this passage. We looked at it briefly the other day. Ezekiel 39, 25 to 28. "Therefore thus saith Adonai Yahweh, now will I bring again the captivity of Jacob and have mercy upon the whole house of Israel," all of them, and will be jealous for my holy name. Yes, because of what Nimrod's done to them. After that they have borne their shame and all their trespasses whereby they have trespassed against me, when would be the height of their arrogance and their pride against him? Hasn't even arrived yet. Still to come. When they dwelt safely in their land and none made them afraid. Some of you will be aware that the modern nation of Israel regards itself to be its own Messiah. You aware of that? In this wonderful book, Bible and Sword, written by a historian, a Jewish historian called Barbara Tuchman, who died a few years ago, she says this. It follows the history of British involvement with the Jews. Not until they came to perceive, beginning in the 1860s, that they would have to act as their own Messiah, did the return to Israel actually become realisable. Heinrich Graetz wrote in his history, "The Jewish people must be their own Messiah." That was written in 1864. While Brother Thomas was writing Volume 3 of Eureka. When a group of Christadelphians went to the land, including Brother John Martin, in the early 1970s, they met Rabbi Abrahams. Interesting name, isn't it? Rabbi Abrahams in Jerusalem. And they asked him the obvious question. Are you in expectation of the Messiah? This is a rabbi. He said, "We are the Messiah." Eh? That's why Zechariah 12, 13 and 14 is in our Bibles. Would you turn there with me? I have 3 minutes. Let's do the best we can. Zechariah 14, first of all. Verse 5. This is the great earthquake of Armageddon. It's not that far away, brothers and sisters. "And ye shall flee from the valley of the mountains, for the valley of the mountains shall reach very near. Yea, ye shall flee like as ye fled from before the earthquake in the days of Uzziah, king of Judah. Yahweh my God shall come, and all the saints with thee." So we're going to be there. When Christ arrives, we're going to be there, or at least most of us will be there. We're going to see this happen. "And the great earthquake is likened to the earthquake in the days of Uzziah." Why? Well, think about Uzziah. You can go back to the record of 2 Chronicles 26 and see what that man achieved in his life. As a 16-year-old, he captured a lad. He defeated the Philistines, the Palestinians, you might say, of his day. And the Moabites and the Ammonites. And they had to bow down to him, so to speak. He brought water into the desert. He was an agricultural man. His achievements in that area were incredible. Just like Israel's. You use a watering system at home, black plastic watering system, trickle feed watering. You use that here? The Jews invented that. They brought water into the desert. They've got a great water carrier that brought water to the Negev. You eat Jewish oranges. They are a very productive nation. Uzziah had an army of 300,000 men. You know what the size of the Israeli army is? 300,000 men. He was the inventor of unique weaponry. Cunning weapons. He fortified Jerusalem. In the 1960s, you couldn't build a building in Jerusalem unless it was nuclear proof, nuclear war proof. You can show that the pattern of Uzziah's success from his early time, 16 years of age, until he was smitten in the forehead because of leprosy, you can show that he was greatly helped by Yahweh, which is true of Israel. That pattern follows the success of the modern nation of Israel precisely. So he was a man who was the son of David, who could have been a wonderful type of our Lord Jesus Christ as King. But he wasn't satisfied with that because, you see, he knew that Christ was going to be, like you and I know, and David knew, that Christ the King was going to be both King and Priest. Now, it just so happened that the man who was High Priest at the time was called Azariah. That was the other name of Uzziah. So he thought, I'll displace the other Azariah and I'll become Azariah, king and priest. Because you see, after 40 years of unmitigated success, he began to ask a simple question. When Messiah cometh, will he do greater works than this man, Uzziah? His answer was no. So he went into the temple. He seized the priest, or wanted to seize the priest. He's smitten in the forehead with leprosy. And he has to dwell in a house apart. That is a type of modern Israel. That's why in Zechariah 12 you read this in verse 12. That when they finally realise who the true Messiah is, it says in verse 12, and the land shall mourn every family apart. And 11 times that's mentioned. 11, the number of failure. Then you read in Zechariah 13 verse 1, in that day there shall be a fountain opened to the house of David and to the inhabitants of Jerusalem for sin and for uncleanness. Under the law you washed for a couple of reasons, and one of them is that you were cleansed from leprosy. Little wonder that the great earthquake coming is like the earthquake in the days of Uzziah. So finally, brothers and sisters, Ezekiel concludes this way. When I have brought them again from the people and gathered them out of their enemies' lands and am sanctified in them in the sight of many nations, then shall they know that I am Yahweh their God, which caused them to be led into captivity among the nations. But I have gathered them unto their own land and have left none of them any more there. So Zephaniah 3 concludes with these words. Behold, at that time I will undo all that afflict thee, and I will save her that halteth, and gather her that was driven out, and I will get them praise and a name in every land where they have been put to shame. At that time will I bring you again, even in the time that I gather you, for I will make you a name and a praise among all peoples of the earth, when I turn back your captivity before your eyes, saith Yahweh. The last word in the Hebrew is Yahweh, he who will become. It's his work, brothers and sisters. And we stand on the threshold of the great day of our God, when he will entirely reverse the work of Nimrod and undo all the effects of his rebellion. Let us hope and let us pray that in that day, like Zephaniah and Josiah, we shall be hid in the day of Yahweh's anger.